Lecture 8, Founding Fictions of the New Republic.
As the title for this lecture, The Founding Fictions of the New Republic, and the figures gathered under that title, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, Alexis de Tocqueville, Henry Highland Garnett, testify. That founding moment is a moment that is different from the founding moments that we associated with the myth of exceptionalism that was reproduced by Puritan histories as such. Let me, at the outset, make a couple of distinctions between the moment that founded the New Republic and the myth of exceptionalism that derived from the Puritans' code. The distinction can begin to be calibrated by taking up some of the key words that were deployed in order to explain how the myth of American exceptionalism depended upon the imagination of the Puritans. Some of those key words included the Great Migration, the Great Awakening, the errand into the wilderness, and later, the translatio studii. Each one of those terms has reference to a very specific historical event, as well as to the way in which that very specific historical event was subsequently transformed into a doctrine of belief in the Puritan mind. The Great Migration, as you could infer, if not already know from what's been said thus far, referred to the process of moving from a space of religious tyranny and a space of religious intolerance in England, in France, in Germany, and migrating across the sea to the not yet named Republic, later to be called the United States. The Great Migration justified the association of the word migration, which would not be so great, with the word great by interpreting the Great Migration as a repetition of the Israelites' exodus from the land of Pharaoh. The Great Awakening referred to a specific historical event that took place between 1730 and 1750 in the not yet founded United States and broadcast by ministers of the capacity for eloquence, like Jonathan Edwards, who understood the coexistence of a non-religious imagination, namely the imagination that was produced by the larger rational movement called the Enlightenment, as a rival to the spiritual imagination that had motivated the great migration from places of religious persecution. The Great Awakening, 1730 to 1750, asked the Puritans to recall in moments of present crisis where their fidelity to religious doctrine was in contestation with their loyalty to newly emergent principles of political liberty and to privilege the religious over the political principle. The Great Awakening is an event that asked all of the colonists who had experienced the tension and anxiety that would eventuate in the Revolutionary War to internalize that insecurity. And instead of transmuting it into a violent political action, instead understand it as the precondition for rededicating their souls to the regenerate God. The founding of the New Republic depended upon the displacement of those secular terms, I mean those religious terms, the Great Awakening and the Great Migration, with the secular terms associated with the Enlightenment. Thomas Paine, with works such as Common Sense and In Defense of Reason and The Rights of Man, would propose that all of the encouragement that the Puritans had previously been the addressees of to transform their disposition to engage in political struggle into a rededication to religious regeneration. When Thomas Paine addressed through The Rights of Man and Common Sense the imagination that had been restored by the workers in the Great Awakening, he asked them to displace the superstitions of the religious imagination with the reasonable principles and motives that would enable them to undergo real change in an actual material political environment. Thomas Paine began to write his best work at about the same time as Jonathan Edwards and Thomas Whitefield were delivering their most apocalyptic sermons. Apocalyptic, as you'll recall, is a term that refers to the sense of last things being revealed in present time. And instead of Thomas Paine identifying his project with either the Great Awakening or the apocalyptic imagination that it presupposed, identified it instead with the possibility for bettering the historical and political climate in the present. Thomas Paine took the expression translatio studii, which means the translation of studies, the transmigration of knowledge from the East to the West, from Europe to the United States, as the best textual and rational environment for the securing and reproduction of what he believed to be the best possible future for persons who wanted to experience liberty and social justice in a world in which all human beings were understood as created equal. When Thomas Paine published Common Sense in 1775, it was read by one-fifth of the colonial population. It was distributed, digested, and transformed into a set of motives by many of the persons who would later be described as the founders of the New Republic, including the architect of the instrument for the founding of the United States as a new republic, Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, or rather, he co-wrote that document, as a document that was designed to take an event that was otherwise understood as only violent, namely the moment of successful overthrow, the power of British tyranny, as it had previously exercised itself as a yoke around the necks of all of the colonists in the United States.
Transformation of that moment of violence into a declaratory. We the people.
The Declaration of Independence was Thomas Jefferson's means of returning to the moment of revolution that had replaced the moment that the Puritans had called first the Great Migration, then the Great Awakening, with the definitive separation of the mandates, aspirations, memories of a new political entity called the Republic of the United States, with all of the political forms that had preceded it. When Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, the acts of violence associated with the moment of revolution as such had no supplemental document that produced a form explaining the reason for the exercise of violence. It was as if by constructing the document, which began with the phrasing, "We the people," Jefferson and all those who helped him forge that document were, by way of that statement, "We the people," inventing after the fact the entity that had been responsible for establishing the difference between Britain and the United States. Let me put it even more paradoxically. We the people did not exist prior to Jefferson's declaration. We the people were political fiction. Thomas Jefferson and all of those who co-founded by way of that instrument invented in order to ascribe, as a highly motivated, profoundly informed, enlightened action, what otherwise might be understood as an event that was only violent and would regenerate only violence. Thomas Paine's common sense had inspired Jefferson to forge a document called the Declaration of Independence that would depend upon not the Puritans' typological imagination, which was uncommon in its sense, but the enlightened sensibility that had recorded the maxims of Paine's powerful pamphlet. When Jefferson translated Paine's common sense into the informing motive for the production of the Declaration of Independence, he removed from immediate memory the traumatic experience of violent revolution, which is perhaps more antithetical to what is common in sense than any event that had previously taken place within the environs of the United States, with a statement that translated revolution into resolve, that translated violence into an aspiration that all citizens be granted as their birthright, life, liberty, and not property, as had been the case in Paine's common sense, but the pursuit of happiness. Call attention at the beginning of these remarks to the configuration that brought Thomas Paine into the same intellectual ambit as the founders of the new republic
in order to call attention to the way in which that particular historical alliance was able to transform what otherwise would have been experienced as a strictly traumatic and perhaps repeatable event into the precondition for the most orderly succession of political power that had yet taken place in the Western world. This lecture is entitled "The Founding Fictions of the New Republic," because the Declaration of Independence, insofar as it utilizes words such as liberty, such as equality, such as social justice, such as natural law, depended upon political fictions that had nothing but abstract value and would lack material reference until the people that had been called into existence by way of the instrument called the Declaration of Independence would give political form to these otherwise numinous, even somewhat spiritual abstractions. Liberty, justice, equality, happiness. I further associated Paine's relation to Jefferson with Alexis de Tocqueville because Democracy in America was a text Alexis de Tocqueville would produce some 50 years after the founding of the New Republic in the United States in order to establish a means of getting the revolution out of the French political public. When Alexis de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America, he was not writing simply as a traveler who wished to report objectively about events and persons he had encountered in the United States. Alexis de Tocqueville was a magistrate in France who had been commissioned by French authorities to come to the United States and discover how the United States had managed to bring about a complete transformation in the identity of a political entity without the instrument of that transformation, namely the revolution, remaining as a constant form of terror. Alexis de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America in order to understand how the political fictions that were constructive and reproductive of the United States had enabled an orderly succession from the revolutionary times to Andrew Jackson's administration. When de Tocqueville wrote Democracy in America, he wrote with this as the understanding of his mandate. I want to take the revolutionary aspirations of Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson and discover how those revolutionary aspirations had resulted in highly conservative political formations that permitted restraint and order to prevail in the American Republic when they had not prevailed in the French Republic. De Tocqueville, to put it too starkly, might be understood as Thomas Paine's opposite. Whereas Thomas Paine wrote pamphlets in the United States and then in 1791 migrated to France to publish there the rights of man and encourage in France the terrorist and counter-terrorist activities that so distressed the French aristocrat with large property holdings throughout the South, Alexis de Tocqueville. If Alexis de Tocqueville constructed himself as Thomas Paine's opposite almost 60 years after the Declaration of Independence, Henry Highland Garnett, writing as a black abolitionist, remade himself in the image of Thomas Paine in Jacksonian America in order to demand the return of actual revolutionary violence, so that the fundamental contradiction that was at work in the Declaration of Independence, namely the existence within the world in which independence had been declared of categories of unfree people called slaves, could be abolished from the Republic altogether. Whereas de Tocqueville had repressed Paine for the sake of establishing a conservative republic, Garnett not only recollected but incarnated Thomas Paine. And Bill Cook will explain precisely how in the next segment of this lecture.
Don Pease spoke about the invention that is at the heart of Declaration of Independence. That same invention is in operation in Henry Highland Garnett. But what Henry Highland Garnett did was to take those abstractions to which he referred, the fiction, if you will, to read those abstractions if they were quite concrete, to read them as if they had an actual base in material reality, to read them as history, as political fact, and not as invention, the willful misreading of those documents. And I'll demonstrate how that occurs in a moment. But because he is not as well known, having been very much eclipsed by Douglas, just a word or two on Garnett as a person, for his very life itself was rather exemplary of the political philosophy which he preached. He was born a slave in Maryland, but his father, again, adopting the ruse that he was taking his family to a funeral, got in the wagon with them and rode off to freedom. So at age 9, Garnett was free, went to school for a while in New York City at the African Free School. But they were pursued in New York City by slave catchers. For 2 years, that haunting went on. Garnett, enraged, always went armed, for he was not going to be recaptured. He then went to Canaan, New Hampshire, to attend school there, an experimental school called Noyes Academy. The townspeople were not at all happy to have the Negro students in their midst. They raided the school, but Garnett got a gun, an ammunition, barricaded the school, fired out into the crowd. But with no great effect, for the townspeople then gathered oxen, dragged the school building outside the town limits and burned it to the ground. But Garnett did continue his education at the Oneida Institute. He was ordained in 1843, and that's the operative year for us. For it was in 1843 that he delivered that speech, an address to the slaves of the United States of America, an address that shocked Douglas, shocked a good part of that convention in Buffalo, New York, but missed being adopted as a policy of that convention by only one vote. Ironically, 4 years later, the speech was republished. No one seemed to find it frightening as it was found in 1843. Also, Garnett went on to become the first black person to address the House of Representatives. That is the state of his reputation as Speaker. That was 1865. He recruited troops during the Civil War, gathered supplies, very active there, and finally, the year of his death, was named Minister and Consul General to the nation of Liberia in West Africa, and he died there. But that bit of a bio to talk about what the man was like, this powerful speaker, he had a wooden leg, he lost a leg also, but he would very often gesticulate wildly with that wooden leg. He was not a speaker like me, standing dignifiedly in one place, but he got audiences out of their seats. Now, what did I mean by a willful misreading of the document, the Declaration? A willful misreading, because he knew full well what the all men meant in that document, but he knew out of his context that it also included him. And so his address to the slaves of the United States, his title, the first words in that address, brethren and fellow citizens. If Jefferson invented a political entity, certainly Garnett does, with that brethren and fellow citizens. He unites in that one statement all black slave or free, and he records that birthright of citizenship of for all of them, knowing full well that is not the case. But if you take the words literally, you can create counter myth. For him, there is no such thing as freedom for those blacks who call themselves freed slaves if other blacks are still enslaved. He insists one is bound to the other. But he also is one of the first to insist on agency for the slaves, for he will argue that they must act, they must strike to achieve their freedom. But he is more subtle, it seems to me, when we look at formal aspects of that speech. It certainly plays with ideas of Jefferson, with ideas of Paine, but it also appropriates the very form of the Declaration of Independence, bringing the weight of that form over to its argument. What do I mean by that? We're looking, as Don Pease has already told you, at an age of enlightenment, age of reason, a neoclassical document. And if we want to get rid of some terms like property and substitute for that pursuit of happiness, we also want to make other shifts. In the early drafts, we hold these truths to be sacred, we read. That is not an appeal to reason. So we change that wording to we hold these truths to be self-evident. A radical difference there. What is the form that Garnett borrows? He borrows the form of the syllogism. And the Declaration of Independence is a large syllogism. You're wondering what a syllogism is, and I will endeavor to define. In this form of argument, we are careful to arrange the argument in three parts. The major premise, or the major proposition, the first part, states a general principle, a general truth. We hold these truths to be self-evident, all men are created, etc., etc., etc. The second part of the syllogism, we call the minor premise. And in the minor premise, we will argue a specific. Here is the general condition of man. Here is what the Creator has deemed and ordained man will be. What will man possess? Here is our situation. If we must announce reasons for rebellion, then in our second premise, we must state our situation. And in that section of the Declaration, we enumerate the offenses of the British Crown. We enumerate our attempts to respond rationally, logically, legally, and without violence. And then we move to the third part of the syllogism, the conclusion, which we arrive at from the convergence between A and B, first and second part. If these are rights of all people, and if people must announce to the world the reasons for what they're doing, let us give you the particulars of our condition. Our condition certainly is a condition in violation of these rights. Therefore, we declare that these are and ought to be free. The syllogism, that is exactly the form of Garnet's address to the slaves of the United States. He begins the first or his major premise, demonstrating that slavery is condemned by the Bible, by God, by angels, by justice as a horror. He then moves to a mighty peroration in which he insists that the slaves look around and note the numbers of the horrors which characterize their days. That's a powerful, powerful moment in that mid. And then we arrive at the logical conclusion, all else having failed, you have no recourse but resistance, resistance, resistance. And resurrecting Patrick Henry, he then patterns Henry's liberty or death, weaving that into an elaborate argument that death is better by any standard than that which you experience now. But again, following his models, the first instructions are peaceful. You should go to your masters, tell them you will be free. If they refuse, cease to work for them. If they begin violence and bloodshed, and blood is a word we find all over that one, well, that's it. Blood is where it is. And weaving not only in their die now, that is better than living as a slave and entailing slavery to your descendants. Die at once. And he begins a repetition on that variation on give me liberty or give me death. And remember, you are 4 million. Your numbers are not small. The speech shocks Douglas, as it shocked many listeners, not only for the call to revolution, not only because it is one of the earliest works in which we define a black community that is one. Its goals are tied to the goals of all members of that community. But more than that, the insistence by Garnet that you must resist, you must shed blood. Declaration then coming out of its age and attempting, in a sense, to codify and erase violence, that conservative goal that Don spoke of, Henry Highland Garnet, by resurrecting Payne and Patrick Henry, reinserts violence into the discourse of freedom, that it is a necessary. And what is interesting are the ways in which we hear echoes, freedom now, freedom in this generation, coinages of Henry Highland Garnet. And so coming back to that Age of Enlightenment doctrine and its careful patterning, its syllogistic form, even its use of the rhetorical figure membrum as opening and closing device, membrum a three-part figure in oratory, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, opens the full discussion, which closes with the same figure, we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. That is the oratorical space into which Garnet moves, reinserting violence, inventing a new black voice, denying that that voice must be in supplication for its rights, since they are natural rights. Fellow citizens, he addresses his listeners, the slaves, insisting that it is not a matter of waiting, a matter of time. Since they are natural rights, they must be immediately exercised. Garnet's ploy, then, is to deny the fiction of the text which he addresses, particularly the Declaration of Independence, but to read that document literally, to empty it of its initial myths, if you will, and to reinsert into that space another myth for African Americans.
Bill, in your compelling account of Garnet's redaction of the Declaration of Independence and his deployment of that document as an instrument in the emancipatory aspirations of the abolitionist movement, you've indicated one strain of Garnet's project, but you implied another when you called attention to his experiences in Canaan, New Hampshire, which seemed to depend upon the religious enlightenment as opposed to the philosophical enlightenment as the basis for its persuasive power. Am I willfully misreading what you're saying, or is that at work?
No, because I would give you the year 1843 again. 1843 is the year he delivers his address to the slaves of the United States of America, and is also the year in which he is ordained a Presbyterian minister. And the latter part of his life is spent in an active ministry. The entire experience at Canaan develops in him that belief that violence may be the necessary approach, but it does not mean he abandons the possibility that there are other approaches. And so he does become, at the same time you might think he's a firebrand or bomb-tossing radical, he also becomes in that same year minister, a Presbyterian minister. And one other point there, what does he do in the very middle of his address to the slaves? He literally rewrites a history, because he begins with Patrick Henry, but goes on to Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, Madison Washington, Joseph Cinquez, all of those African Americans who led revolts against slave power. And interesting that he sandwiches the list of them between the words of Patrick Henry.
So that
to refer back now to one of the major points we've been making throughout the preceding lectures, namely the power of what you call the typological box to efface contradiction. Henry Highland Garnett, in his sermon, has in effect produced a contradiction that breaks the typological box and called attention thereby to the need to produce a literal change rather than accept religious typology as a substitute.
It's again almost impossible after a Garnett to any longer pretend that there is not a disjunction between the nation's founding myths and the nation's reality, because it becomes that literal reading that comes back again and again and again in the years preceding and following the Civil War.